crisis in Yemen should be top on agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman's capital, Muscat, failed to find a solution to the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. According to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen has killed almost a quarter of a million Yemenis, caused outbreaks of disease, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and brought the poor Arab country to the verge of famine.
Yemenis are optimistic about the Omani delegation visit to their country, saying Oman is capable of achieving what the UN envoy has failed during the past years and putting an end to the suffering of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As India continues to battle the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the destitute Rohingya community fights it all alone. The community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. Rights activists say they are in desperate need of help as the virus has started raging across the camps.
First they started the deportation drive, then detention, and now the lockdowns. Why are all miseries for us? Why is the world silent? Don't we have the right to live? We have no work due to lockdowns, and now this virus is frightening us, since we can't get access to any healthcare services here.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought more miseries to the community, since most of them used to work in the unorganized sector. Now, due to lockdowns, most of them have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity, while hunger and poverty looms over the community. The refugee camps are cramped, and the spread of virus is inevitable, they say, since their makeshift shanties lean on each other with no sanitation, food support, or health care, since they are not included in the government's support programs. Most of them work as daily wage workers or scrap collectors to make a living, but the government restrictions and lockdown has left many out of work.
Some locals and NGOs are helping us with food and other essentials in these dire times. We, however, urge the UN Refugee Agency to play their part. We don't need just guidelines. We need access to vaccination.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different Indian states.
In recent weeks, many of these refugees, including children, had developed COVID-like symptoms. But due to lack of testing facilities and shortage of vaccine, they're on their own. Most of them have resorted to home remedies and self-quarantine. Many, however, fear if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine, a humanitarian disaster awaits their community. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
In the limelight.
The progressive New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has criticized Vice President Kamala Harris for saying undocumented migrants from Guatemala should not come to the United States. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Gloria Oladipo. The piece is titled AOC condemns Kamala Harris for telling Guatemalan migrants not to come to U.S. On her first foreign trip as vice president, Kamala Harris visited Guatemala on Monday. At a press conference with Guatemala's president, Alejandro Yamatei, the The former California senator spoke about investigating corruption and human trafficking in Central America and described a future where Guatemalans could find hope at home. But she also had a clear message that undocumented Guatemalan migrants would not find solace at the U.S. border under the Biden administration. I want to be clear to folks in the region who are thinking about making that dangerous trek to the United States-Mexico border, she said. Do not come. Do not come. Later on Monday, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez criticized Kamala Harris on Twitter, calling her comments disappointing to see. First, seeking asylum at any U.S. border is a 100% legal method of arrival, said the congresswoman, an influential voice on the Democratic left since her upset win in the 2018 primary and widely known as AOC. Second, the U.S. spent decades contributing to regime change and destabilization in Latin America. We can't help set someone's house on fire and then blame them for fleeing. Several human rights groups also spoke out. Rachel Schmidtke, a Latin America advocate at the nonprofit Refugee International, said, "We continue to urge the Biden administration to build policies that recognize that many Guatemalans will need to seek protection until the long-standing drivers of forced displacement are addressed and realign its message to the Guatemalan people to reflect America's commitment to the right to seek protection internationally." The Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project, a non-profit organization that works with asylum seekers, tweeted, "Kamala Harris seeking asylum is legal. Turning back asylum seekers is illegal, dangerous, and oftentimes sends them back to their deaths. Seeking asylum is a right under U.S. and international law." President Kamala Harris, who visited Mexico on Tuesday, 8th of June, also faced questions about her choice not to visit the U.S.-Mexico border as part of a trip, saying that her focus was on addressing the root causes that prompt migrants to flee their homes. "I'm in Guatemala because my focus is dealing with the root causes of migration," Kamala Harris told NBC's Lester Holt. "There may be some who think that is not important, but it is my firm belief that if we care about what's happening at the border, we better care about the root causes and address them." During the NBC interview with Lester Holt, she dismissed the question on why she hadn't yet visited the border as vice president by responding, "And I haven't been to Europe, and I mean, I don't understand the point that you're making. I'm not discounting the importance of the border." Speaking to reporters in Mexico City, Kamala Harris also pledged she would eventually visit the border. Despite President Joe Biden moving to undo Trump-era restrictions at the border, including instituting changes to the asylum process, Kamala Harris's speech on Monday underlined a continued stance of turning back undocumented migrants. Central America has long been affected by poverty and violence amid entrenched cycles of political instability, partly caused by criminal elites. Experts contend that the United States has often aided oppressive regimes. Despite the litany of dangers migrants often face when traveling north, the journey is often safer than remaining at home. People are leaving because the corrupt governments supported by the United States have tolerated and encouraged the growth of these criminal organizations, said Jeff Fu, the founder of the Economic Policy Institute, in an interview with USA Today. In April, according to CNN, more than 178,000 migrants arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border, the highest one-month total in two decades.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key. Here at IRIB English Radio, I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. As you know, we've been examining God's justice, and we said that justice means that something is placed in the place that is suitable to it, placing something somewhere that's suitable to it. And we said that there are various categories for this meaning of justice. Like we said, in the sense of the term, justice is an attribute of God's actions. It's a property and characteristic and description of God's actions. It means that God's actions are performed in a way that's suitable and it's proper. Like we said, there are three categories for justice: cosmological justice, legislative justice, and judicial justice or penal justice. The question we want to ask today is this: what do we mean by legislative justice? The answer to this question is that when we say that God is legislatively just, it means that God grants the human being and reveals to human beings those laws that are necessary for the acquisition of the perfection that human beings have the capability for. God Almighty grants human beings and explains to them those laws that are necessary for the acquisition of the perfection and the felicity that man has the capability for. Man has the capability to attain felicity in the hereafter, but in order for him to attain this felicity, this perfection, this happiness in the hereafter, he has to perform certain things in this world, certain tasks, certain actions in this world. However, he doesn't know which actions he has to perform. Therefore, it's necessary for God, as a just being who has created this human being, to reveal to him, to tell him about those actions, to order him to perform those actions, right? These orders and these recommendations, which as a whole form a law, right, manifest God's legislative justice, meaning he does something that's suitable. It's suitable for God, who is the creator of this being, which is the human being, who has the capability of achieving this felicity by the performance of his actions. It's suitable for this God and this creator to tell this being about what is necessary for him to do in order to achieve it. If God reveals these laws to this human being, he's just, otherwise he doesn't. This sa'adat or this felicity could be the felicity in the hereafter. It could also be felicity in this world. The human beings and human society has the ability to achieve a certain level of felicity and happiness, material and worldly, in this world, aside from the otherworldly felicity and happiness that he can achieve in the hereafter. He can achieve felicity in this world as well. It's capable, it's possible. However, in order for him to do so, he has to perform certain actions. God, as the creator of this beings, these human beings, it's suitable to him, it's proper for him to reveal to these human beings the actions that are necessary for them to perform to achieve that worldly felicity. Those laws, right, are the responsibilities that he must do. The totality of those responsibilities form a law which we call in Islam the Shariat, right, which were manifested and in the actions and the words of the Prophet, and also the laws that have been explained in the Holy Quran. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We are examining the meaning of legislative justice. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
People.
Floyd tragedy a year on.
The murder of George Floyd made him a household name overnight. With Eric Chauvin kneeling on his neck and ignoring the bystanders, incremental shortage of breath led to an incredible tragedy that impacted the course of the black movement in America.
I think if we had just had him pass away or die and nothing happened as a result of it, it would have felt like it was not worth the pain and suffering. And don't get me wrong, I definitely wish I could have him back, but since we can't, this is nice to be able to see all of the people who are in support of us.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamagi. Floyd's tragic death, whose footage shocked the world, ended up being quite consequential. The former Minneapolis police officer was ultimately found guilty of all three charges. The sentence was essential to appease the black community with a piece of justice after decades of ongoing brutality against the African-American community.
That hopefully one day our world will change, and that there will be and still will be, continue to be, blind justice. I really want that to happen before I die.
A year ago, around this time, Minneapolis was on fire. Entire buildings and, in some cases, blocks. Floyd was killed over an alleged misdemeanor offense. He died under the knee of a police officer, positing a case that brought the issue of racism to the forefront. Floyd's death was different in that it was undeniably brutal.
Hey, look at you. Your body language explains it, you f***ing bum.
It's the whites. They love them as
well. I already know that, bro. I trained with half of these bum ass dudes at the academy, bro. You know that's bogus right now, bro.
Most Americans could not ignore what the cell phone video showed and the message that Floyd was sending to the whole nation and beyond. Therefore, he kickstarted an unapologetic recalibration of how Americans think about race.
We're now joined by Margaret Kimberly, the co-founder of Black Agenda Report from New York. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. Good to be back.
Ms. Kimberly, a year after the Floyd tragedy, has the American law enforcement learned anything about systematic racism among police forces?
No, they haven't learned anything because they are the ones who are systemically racist. They have not changed. They know that they work with the system, and the goal of the system is to keep black people in particular, under physical control. So no, they don't see things any differently, and I think that's an expectation we should not have. Our goal should be to make sure that the rest of us talk about systemic racism and the role that law enforcement plays, and making certain that they cannot behave as they have in the past.
Definitely some very interesting points there. Many thanks for your insight, Ms. Kimberly.
The American nation honored the life of George Floyd with memorial events and marches 1 year after his demise. The George Floyd family also visited the White House and met with President Joe Biden.
As Floyd's name was echoing across the country, other symbolic figures came to mind, such as 18-year-old Michael Brown Jr., who was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, 2014. Many lives have indeed been lost to violence and police brutality in America. Our next guest is Gerald Horn, a professor of American and African Studies at the University of Houston, Texas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Many thanks. Professor Horn, how do you think the brutal murder of George Floyd has influenced policing in America?
There has been a flood, a tidal wave of journalism and writing and stories on television about racism, police violence, etc. But as noted, I don't think that has stemmed the tide with regard to police violence, as evidenced by the growing numbers of black people who are still being killed. If anything, as noted, it might have caused police officers to become more cautious to make sure that no one is filming them when they're killing suspects or killing black people.
Many thanks for your insight, Dr. Gerald Horn.
Floyd's case was a high-profile one with a rather pleasing resolution meant to calm the public and put an end to protests that could have otherwise raged on for years to come. Cases of police brutality against people of color do not often end like that.
As the former Minneapolis police officer was being removed from court in handcuffs, many were wondering whether justice has really been served. Is this an end, or is it just a turning point in the long journey of defending the people of color's rights in the United States?
That racial profiling should be ditched, should be eliminated. But I don't think that's the lesson that has been learned. I think that a lesson that should be learned is that if you want to convict an officer for police brutality, you should make sure that the prosecution is able to contract with expert witnesses, as happened in the Derek Chauvin case. You should make sure that an expert selection of the jury takes place, as happened in the Derek Chauvin case.
George Floyd and what happened to him is now also symbolic of an age-old American struggle still far from results. Institutional systemic change is yet to materialize. Racism in the United States comprises negative attitudes and views on race or ethnicity, which could have deadly consequences in police encounters with minorities.
Hands out to the side! Hands out to the side, now!
Hill lay for more than 6 minutes without aid, a violation of police policy. He was later pronounced dead at the hospital.
To see him lying in the driveway, minute after minute after minute, with no attempt to render aid, and that is a stunning disregard for life, and in this case, black life.
Systemic racism is not simply a thing of the past, but is deeply embedded within the American society. Throughout the country's history, the hallmarks of the so-called American democracy have been largely reserved for white people.
They can't assume that they can let the police get away with this. There have been other cases of killings caught on video where the police nevertheless were either not charged or weren't indicted and therefore put on trial, or were found not guilty if they do go on trial. But I think they know there's a possibility that the police can be charged and may have to pay a price.
Floyd was a normal citizen who got tangled in an altercation with police. He resisted arrest due to shortage of breath and lost his life after saying the iconic "I can't breathe" sentence, which had already become a Black Lives Matter slogan. With injustice and police brutality raging on against minorities, Derek Chauvin's sentence led to a rare moment of accountability in the U.S. judicial system.
We the jury in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. Signed juror foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count two. We the jury in the above entitled matter as to count two, third degree murder perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty.
The system tried to portray Chauvin as an isolated racist in the police department, but many activists believe that there is systematic racism within the justice system, and that is the main cause for victimization of other races. But what can come out of a combination of racism and a highly militarized police force?
The police that routinely patrol black communities, you would think that they were in Fallujah or in Kabul, Afghanistan. That is to say, they are heavily armed, even though the people they are confronting do not even have rocks or slingshots. So certainly we need to demilitarize the police. Defunding the police basically means that you do not need a man or woman with a gun to stop a driver to see if their license is operative, to stop a driver to see if the light on their back tail is operative.
Many other African Americans have been shot since Floyd's death, warning the nation that police brutality, gun violence, and racism are here to stay. Like many other states in America, violence in Minneapolis is commonplace.
Floyd's passing is a painful reminder of the price the African American community has paid in the country. He was an ordinary black man, but his demise enabled him to do something that most have not. Floyd transcended imposed barriers in the society and elevated important conversations in the United States. But what role did Floyd's death play in the Black Lives Matter movement, and what lies ahead for the movement in the immediate future?
The murder of George Floyd in May 25, 2020, electrified the Black Lives Matter movement. I think particularly heartening to this movement were the solidarity demonstrations overseas, not least in Western Europe, not least in Australia, not least in Africa itself. Indeed, you may know that the African Union, headquartered in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, was ready to launch a human rights investigation of the United States of America in the wake of the George Floyd killing.
Today, the black community is struggling to find its footing, be it through fire or through greed. As a result, Americans are reimagining the idea of safety and security. They want policies to change for the sake of blind justice. Chauvin's abuse of power has had far-reaching impacts on policing, not only in Minneapolis, but also around the country. More than anything else, Black Lives Matter activists are calling for police reform. On top of the agenda is banning chokeholds, eliminating no-knock warrants, and creating a national registry for police misconduct. What about defunding the police? Is that a viable solution?
Here in New York City, where I live, they claim to have cut the police budget, but they didn't at all. They just took certain jobs out of the police budget, but they didn't change policing. That has to be the demand to change policing, because if you just say take money away from the police, it can mean any number of things. They can call private police. So what the demand should be to change policing and to minimize its role in society, that has to be the demands, because if you only talk about money, it's easy for them to pretend that there has been some change when there has not been.
Efforts to bring about real change have stalled in the Congress, mostly due to opposition from Republicans, who do not want suing police to be easy and their qualified immunity violated. This is why, since Floyd's death, more than 1,000 people have died following police encounters. Can the Congress solve this?
Look, the fundamentals of this bill has to be greater transparency in American policing, greater accountability in American policing, and then when bad things happen, officers have to be held accountable. I don't want to negotiate parts of this out. This is actually a vast bill dealing with everything from what data small departments have to collect in around America all the way to dealing with big issues like mental health, both of officers as well as the challenges officers have when they encounter people with mental health. So I've been encouraged that we have been working not only long days, but through weekends to advance this bill.
Law enforcement in the United States has no choice but to pave the way for greater accountability and transparency in policing. Floyd's death unified people from all genders, races, and religions on the issue of social justice and police reform. People took part in marches to commemorate him and make sure their voice is heard.
The words Black Lives Matter it's not just about that particular organization. It's about a larger movement. It's a rallying cry. I think in that sense, Black Lives Matter has been strengthened. And I think people understand the importance of taking action, taking direct action when these killings and these acts of brutality take place. So I think it has emboldened people and strengthened this movement.
Gun violence and police brutality are frequently reported in the United States. Most of such cases usually end in favor of police, with the families of color having to pay for the consequences. Floyd's trial was broadcast live in its entirety over COVID-19 restrictions.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:44 p.m. Signed, juror foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count two. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count two, third degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:45 p.m. Signed by jury foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count three. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count three, second degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty.
That gave the public a rare look into the high-profile legal battle in real time. This has led to a rising wave of questions about the functionality of the legal system in terms of seeking justice. Many research studies and investigations attest to the idea that racism is deep-rooted within the U.S. government.
Well, certainly I think that we need to redouble our efforts in the international community. And I would make a special appeal here to our friends and comrades in Iran to be vocal about what's happening to Black people in the United States of America. You may recall that I mentioned the former Secretary of State, Michael Pompeo, who successfully blocked an investigation into police terror in the United States
you may also know that Secretary of State Michael Pompeo was a sworn enemy of Iran, and so it would be in the interest of our friends and comrades in Iran to speak out on our behalf, because when you're speaking out on our behalf, you're speaking out on your behalf.
Many thanks for your insight.
The African-American community needs to assert its international human rights to self-determination. After all, racism is deeply embedded in U.S. social institutions, which means the journey to equality is far from over. Systemic racism seems to have rippled through social institutions and into daily social interactions, making life different for black communities compared to the white.
Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal.
For generations, the United States government had communicated through laws and policies and practices, as well as narratives, that black people were inferior. And then, virtually on a dime, the U.S. government began to say that they were wrong.
On this episode of We the People, I'm happy to be joined by Max Rameau. He's an organizer with Pan-African Community Action and a Haitian-born political theorist and author of the upcoming book on community control over the police. Max, thanks so much for joining us. Let's jump right into it. Over a year has passed since then-police officer Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd, prompting a historic uprising against racist police violence. Can you tell us what's changed in the time since? And I think just as importantly, what hasn't?
So I think the things that have changed is that the fuse for people, particularly working class black people, particularly for people who are overtly repressed by the police, who are victims of police domination and control, their fuse has gotten a lot shorter. So now it doesn't take as long for people to get upset and to lash out at at injustices or perceived injustices. It used to be that urban rebellions happened only after a not guilty verdict came through as a result of a police killing and then some sort of trial. And now, if you think back to, like, for example, the Rodney King rebellion in Los Angeles in 1992. But now people know better than to wait for all that. First of all, I agree with your assessment completely. I think there are now a much larger set of people, including elected or public officials, who are willing to say things like systemic racism exists and that police brutality is real and that it exists, and maybe we should believe black people when they say that they're being harassed by the police. However, I think it's important that we get remain clear at all times about the cause and effect. The reason why that is true is because working class black people rose up and engaged in urban rebellion. The reason that is true is because, not because there's been these police killings and not because black people are unhappy with the police killings. The reason why more prominent people, particularly government officials, are willing to say those kind of things publicly is because this time around, and the last couple times around, certainly since Mike Brown, there's been a few Mike Brown in Ferguson, and then Freddie Gray in Baltimore, and now most spectacularly George Floyd in Minneapolis, this time around, there is a consequence to police murder. So before there's a police murder and the state, all they have to do is hear us whining and complaining, or they have to wait a few more minutes in traffic as we're holding up signs. But as a result of urban rebellions and stepped up actions, there is now a consequence to state violence. And I think that consequence is what's making a difference, is what's opening up some of this ground for this. I think there's a lot of value in the acknowledgement, the public acknowledgement, that there is a that there is systemic racism and there's a problem of police brutality. And the value is that we can now say, okay, if you admit that this is true, then these are the things that you have to do in response to that. So I think that starts moving in that direction. But just want to make crystal clear that we understand that the correlation there is not between these officials saying that and us saying, therefore, this is what you should do. The real correlation is between black communities rising up in rebellion and the officials then responding that, okay, there actually is urban rebellion. There is actually is systemic racism. We accept it.
Yeah, definitely not too difficult to see a connection between, say, the burning of the third precinct in Minneapolis by protesters just over a year ago and these changes we are discussing. Well, we want to thank our guest, Max Rommel, so much for joining us. We want to thank viewers at home for tuning in. Till next time, take care.
Less likely to say, get a job or a home loan. Social institutions, policies, rules, regulations, and laws need to change in order to offer people a fair share. Thank you for watching the show. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Join us again next week when we investigate another issue in the U.S. on We the People. Goodbye.
The light.
Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in thousands. A tiny worm has wriggled back to life after lying frozen for 24,000 years in the permafrost land of northern Siberia. The organism was recovered from soil samples taken from 3.5 meters below the ground in Russia's Yakutia region. It's a multicellular organism that can withstand extreme cold. This ancient worm has broken the record for the longest living abeloid rotifer worm. Previous research suggests that it could survive for a decade when frozen. Earlier, scientists also discovered 30,000-year-old microscopic worms from northern Siberia.
A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province.
The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Eromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran, but when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. A Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the user lowers their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see their third eye.
As the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc in India, some auto rickshaw drivers have turned their three-wheelers into makeshift ambulances to provide patients with first aid services.
In New Delhi, the municipal ambulances are often occupied. There are also some very narrow alleys or built-up areas that are inaccessible by regular-sized ambulances. In these cases, our makeshift ambulances came in handy then. We attend to people in need with oxygen cylinders.
Mishra, who started the Rickshaw Ambulance Initiative, says his center attends around 1,200 calls per day. He says rickshaw volunteers transport roughly 150 patients during peak hours. The brave drivers work 12-hour shifts and mainly serve people with mild symptoms. They wear full protective gear, including face shields, while on duty. The three-wheeler ambulances are easily identifiable by the large printed image of the fleet and emergency call numbers. Mishra says the fleet will continue running with all its might until the coronavirus is under full control in India. In Russia, drone enthusiasts have gathered in the capital, Moscow, to show off their technological creativity in a racing competition. The participants created their own drones and made changes to the models right on the site where the competition was held to improve their chances to win the contest. The goal was for the participants to complete the track in the shortest possible time. Participants say the interesting thing about the competition is that it's cheaper than other games.
It's a lot of fun. From the outside, it may not be so clear, but when you're inside it, it becomes really fun to talk, race with the competitors, learn from their experience some new technological things. As for the high cost, it is expensive, but when compared with the snowboards and skis, it is really cheaper, but more expensive than knitting.
In 2017, the International Federation of Aeronautics, or FAI, announced drone racing as an official sport. In 2018, Russia's sports ministry included drone racing in all Russian register of sports with a class code F3U following the FAI classification.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Stefan Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Two Russian cosmonauts have conducted spacewalk outside the International Space Station to prepare an old docking module for disposal. The duo spent more than 7 hours outside the ISS to wrap up preparations for the eventual disposal of the Pris docking compartment. According to NASA officials, the Russian cargo freighter We'll remove the two-decade-old module from the orbiting laboratory later this summer. Both the cargo ship and a press will burn up in the atmosphere above the Pacific Ocean. The orbiting press will clear the way for the arrival of a new Russian multipurpose laboratory module named Nuka, meaning science in Russian. Nuka is scheduled to launch on July the 15th this year. Wednesday's operation was the SIP-6 spacewalk in 2021 in support of the Space Station Assembly, maintenance, and upgrades.
A rare albino baby elephant that was rescued from poachers in South Africa has found a new home with a welcoming herd. The calf, named Han Yisa, was caught in a snare in the Kruger National Park when she was only 4 months old. She suffered several nasty wounds, including one to her mouth. Han Yisa remained trapped in the snare for 4 days before being rescued and taken to a shelter especially built for elephants northeast of Johannesburg. All the other elephants there are orphans too.
Each female that we had has a baby. So except for them, all of the others are orphaned. And I think that is part of the reason why they accept these orphans, because they know how it feels, you know, and they become actually, you know, the mother figures for them.
The calf has learned to adapt to the new life. She lies under the shadow cast by bigger elephants to protect herself from getting sunburned. The shelter says if the herd grows too big for the area, she and other elephants will be released into the wild. A Brazilian artist has found a way to reuse plastic bags in a very creative way, making something beautiful out of them. Eduardo Sroa turns recycled shreds of plastic into real pieces of artwork. He picks up the material from city streets and rivers. Without using a drop of paint, Sroa recreates paintings by Picasso, Van Gogh, and other famous artists. He says his goal is to draw attention to plastic pollution.
I present this series as a product that does not have paint, except for what has already been processed into plastic by the industry. It does not have glue. It is a box that was built, and inside I press and condense it. I make an accumulated cluster of plastic bags that ends up creating this image that you see.
Sura's exhibition is due to open in Sao Paulo in the coming months. His previous works were also aimed at raising awareness about the environment. He has created several giant installations in public places, mostly along polluted rivers.
Chinese archaeologists have unearthed a rare 3,000-year-old bronze figure from a site they have been excavating for months in Sichuan province. The 1.5-meter figure, deemed one of China's most famous archaeological discoveries, it consists of two parts. The upper part is 55 centimeters high, with a zoon, a vessel used in ancient times, on top of the head. The lower part is 60 centimeters in size, with kneeling posture. Similar findings in the past were just 20 centimeters in their heights. The bronze figure was discovered under massive ivory objects. So far, over 500 objects, including ivory, bronze, gold, and jade ware, have been found from six sacrificial pits of the Sanjiangdu ruins.
IRIB English Radio.